Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the topic, why is there no unified progressive movement, and what is necessary to build one? My guest is Professor Jim Garrison. We're speaking to him today through Skype in London, United Kingdom. Jim is the founding president of Ubiquity University and the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies, which is an international program for higher education built upon innovative principles of whole brain, whole system learning. University operates on four continents with partners in the European Union, India, Mexico, and South Africa, Russia, Vietnam, and other nations. He also is the co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation. He was an instrumental person in the founding of the State of the World Forum to lay a template for a more sustainable global civilization. In the late 80s, he served as the executive director of the Esalen Institute of Soviet American Exchange and founded the International Foreign Policy Association in collaboration with Secretary of State George Shultz. And he is the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power, as well as Civilization in the Transformation of Power. Jim has degrees in religion and theology from Harvard University, Cambridge University, and his websites are wisdomuniversity.org and ubiquityuniversity.org. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Good to be here.
Jim, I think all of us who consider ourselves progressive, and I'm not referring now to left, right, conservative, or liberal. Those are completely unique and distinctive groups of individuals and beliefs. The progressive, from my perspective, and the reason I founded the Progressive Radio Network, is for those people who see the limitation, as well as with other strengths they might have, within a narrowly defined system where they're living through an ideology. And even when the ideology does not match or align or balance or harmonize with reality, more often than not, they choose the ideology. So even when you have a bad president, and if you're a Democrat, Clinton or Obama, all they promised, they don't deliver on. In fact, they frequently deliver just the opposite. We give a man a Nobel Prize for Peace, and he starts wars in seven countries and undermines at least nine different democratically elected governments. And yet we posit, well, we don't want anyone interfering in our election. And that's been the central theme in politics for the last 8 months. The Russians, involved in our election, to the degree that they were, show the evidence. But more often than not, it's not that this was an issue. And if Hillary Clinton had won, it wouldn't be an issue at all. It's our candidate didn't win. But did you ever ask yourself, what does your candidate stand for? Let's go back and look at their records. Were they for peace? Did they de-ghettoize America? Did they bring down childhood poverty? What did they do? Did they protect the environment? Did they heal wounds deep and painful within the Middle East for our involvement there? Did they rebuild cities? Did they demilitarize? The answer is no. In fact, on all the important issues, they did not touch these. So why should we continue to believe in them? So that's just as a backdrop, because then along comes Ralph Nader, and then Rocky Anderson, Jill Stein, then Jill Stein again. And when I asked them 35 questions, for example, would you close down military bases around the world, over 900? It was yes. Would you also have universal health care? Yes. Would you close down at least 16 of the 17 spy agencies that we don't need, these intelligence agencies? Yes. And would you label GMOs? Yes. Would you take the politics out of our election campaign by advocating for no money in any campaign? Yes. So on all the issues that really count, they were yes. Meaning by any measurement, their world would be far more safe, peaceful, healthy, and happy if any of these people had been elected. And yet, in the last election, Jill Stein received under 1% of the vote, just about a million votes. The Democrats, 65 million. The Republicans, about 62, 63 million. So you get about 125 million people voting, 100 million people not voting, and she gets 1 million votes. Now, I have to ask, what the hell is wrong with the American people? Because something is terribly wrong. Those who chose not to vote for the lesser of two evils, well, one of those evils is going to get elected. They had an option, someone who's not evil. Yet they chose not to. So that's where we begin. That's the larger overarching issue today. But a little further, the foundational structures of our dominant institutions are cracking. Free market, laissez-faire capitalism, regressive international trade agreements, and the central multilateral banks are no longer serving the betterment of humanity and have become unsustainable. Our political system and the leading parties are in rudderless chaos. Our major institutions, such as welfare and social reform, education and medicine, are direly challenged and failing miserably. And the entire artifice is now solely held together by the thin threads of excessive power, massive wealth, and unbridled influence. This is not only true in the United States, but in many countries across Europe and elsewhere, where we're witnessing the reemergence of a polarization between nationalist right movements, as with the Trump movement, as with the Netanyahu movement in Israel, and a more global humanitarian consciousness that's getting no attention at all. And at the same time, people are becoming more vocal and active. You're very familiar with Vandana Shiva, one of the most important voices of reason and sustainability in the world. And she said recently on this program that the seeds of the new emerging culture are not to be found outside the dominant regime, but are within the system and will be sown and harvested only within its ruin. And however, from my vantage point, I don't observe a unified humanitarian progressive movement. There are many individual fronts, Black Lives Matter, the anti-fracking movement, pipeline activism, the anti-Trump protests, the environmental and climate change movements, the remnants of the Occupy and others. And these remain splintered, albeit important activities, and there's no single progressive umbrella or container for them all. And one reason is that I don't observe a unified vision based upon sound ethical and spiritual principles that can guide a viable and yet a powerful and influential progressive movement today. In part is because I don't believe that people realize how much power they have individually and collectively. Why is it so difficult for a progressive movement to emerge that is founded on higher morals, whereas it is easier for the political right to agree with its conservative principles and unified supporters, the regressive, corporatized New Democrats, to support virtually all the same industries and all the same policies, just with a different moniker, as the Republicans? And then after that, what might be the underlying ethics to unify progressive movement today? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Wow. Gary, you certainly hit the nail on the head with your question and observations of why it's going to take some time for progressives currently as disunited as they are to seize the moment. I agree with you. I think there's a lot of rhetoric about the seeds of progressivism arising out of the ruins of the old order, but that isn't apparent enough for it to be empirically verified. And so I think, you know, the first thing I would say is that in a time of Trump, your question is probably the most important question that we can ask. And I want to take a vector on Trump that opens up a couple areas of further exploration. You know, if you remember Mephistopheles in Goethe's Faust, he says something right at the beginning when he introduces himself to Faust. And remember, the storyline is Faust is a scholar. He dreams of an infinite world and great wealth, but has neither the capacity nor the resources to bring it into being. He's tempted, and finally, in exchange for giving his soul to the devil, he's promised everything that he has been yearning for. And when Mephistopheles introduces himself to Faust for the first time, he makes a statement that has come back to me many times since the election of Donald Trump. He says, "I am part of that power that constantly wants to do evil and constantly generates good." So I think in Donald Trump, we have actually an opportunity of a lifetime with someone who constantly wants to do evil, colluding with the Russians, obstructing justice, now wanting to open the Arctic Ocean and Arctic ecosystem to unprecedented oil exploration and partnership between ExxonMobil, the former CEO of which is now our Secretary of State, and the Russian oligarchic interests in the most massive oil deal in the history of oil, actually, is what Trump and Tillerson and Putin are cooking up as soon as they can consolidate power, which means we've got to impeach him as quickly as possible. But leaving that aside, the gravity of our moment, if we use it correctly, could answer your question positively. And I would say one further, I believe that if we do not, as progressives, seize the moment offered by Trump to generate as much good as he's generating evil, we may condemn human civilization and history itself to species catastrophe, certainly the radical eroding of civilization as we know it. So that would be the first observation I would make. And then I would make a couple of other observations. And just to reiterate your point about the system, you know, we live in a Machiavellian world. We live in a world where power reigns supreme, where our economic system has stated that greed is good and the accumulation of capital is more important than community or planet or health or the good life. We're in a system of geostrategic relations between nation states that is based on a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. If you win, I lose. And so it's very challenging for anyone to get another paradigm going because of the extraordinary way in which the prevailing system has consolidated itself, not only in institutions, but also in the very religious ideology that gives our cultures its framework, scope, and content. And I think a aspect of that is that we're in a period of time where the Machiavellian order, the order of the nation state, the order of monopoly capitalism, as Marx predicted, is actually imploding on itself because of unbridled greed. And that's an important, you know, prediction that Marx made that is often forgotten, that the capitalist system would at some point, as it does in cyclic patterns, it implodes, like we saw in 1929, like we saw in 2008, 2009, as we saw in the dot-com boom. The capitalist system is victim to cyclic disasters because of the unbridled nature of greed itself. And I think that the extraordinary paradox of our time, Gary, if you know the works of Paul Ray and his research, is that underneath and in spite of the prevailing and increasingly intense national security state that's being built by a contracting, increasingly dense, inflexible system, has been an emergence of what Paul Ray calls cultural creative starting in the 1960s at only a couple percent of the American population, now numbering 30 to 35% of the U.S. population. They're the largest single value proposition in the American culture. The conservatives, you know, the Republicans, the Trump supporters, number less than 25% of the electorate. That's why it's often been observed that Trump's actual constituency is no more than 30%. That means that those of us who believe with you and with me in progressive values are actually a majority in the in the national and global polity. It's the same statistic in Europe, across the EU, in Japan, and in most cosmopolitan centers. The paradox noted by Paul Ray is that the cultural creatives think they're alone because they don't see any of their values reflected back sufficiently to support an engagement in the electoral process. So most of them aren't politically engaged. You know, they're engaged socially, they're engaged philanthropically, they're engaged politically, I would say, small p. But as in terms of Democrat or Republican, they don't come out much. And the phenomenon of Barack Obama in 2008 and what we saw in England in the last election last week with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party getting far more than anybody thought, it's because he was speaking to the progressive values that you point toward. And I raise this because this, to me, is the most consequential fact in our contemporary reality in 2017. Progressives are actually the majority opinion. The institutions are still in the grip of an increasingly ossified, archaic system. You have the NGO communities that, according to Paul Hawken and you know, many other people now are counted in the millions worldwide. There's not an issue confronting the human race right now that is not being covered by dozens, if not hundreds, of NGOs as best they can, even though they're under-resourced, they're understaffed, and challenged in almost every sense of the term. Nevertheless, what is trying to burgeon out as, you know, a dandelion through the concrete is actually there. The question is, how do we, at a time of great duress, how do we bring into focus in a publicly observable way the kind of future we want to have? And I think what caused the collapse of Obama is he completely misread the tea leaves. He did not understand that his mandate after becoming president was to lead the movement that he had ignited with the audacity of hope. And he forsook that and got caught up in the quagmire of Washington politics, never drained the swamp, surrounded himself with alligators, just like Trump is doing, and lost the game. It's going to be very interesting to see whether Jeremy Corbyn in the UK can stay true to those progressive values that got him within a whisker of being prime minister in the United Kingdom. You see Macron in France speaking to European unity, obviously from a conservative right position, but he won in a landslide. So I think we're in a in an inflection moment where more is possible than we think it is, the right wing knows that, and that's why they're doing everything conceivable to cut down on the voter rolls, collude with the Russians, and do all the things that Trump and the Republicans were up to, which is treason. And that's just worth mentioning to the audience here. Donald Trump is guilty of treason. This is high crimes and misdemeanors. When any citizen of any country conspires with a foreign power to engage in a criminal conspiracy, destabilize his own country, particularly the governmental operations, in this case, national elections, that's a crime. That's treason. And in most countries, you're taken out and shot. He was elected. And I think to his everlasting disgrace, Barack Obama did not start an immediate investigation of that and allowed Trump to take office. He's now obstructing justice consistently, and we'll see whether Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, will bring him down. But I believe that it's only the Constitution of the United States that can save us from what I would call our Hitler moment. If we do not stop Trump, we're going to see the death of the world as we know it, because if he stabilizes on the other side of this crisis, what we're going to see is the most massive oil drilling in the history of the world in the Arctic. And that's going to take climate change and almost every planetary indicator over the cliff. So I'll stop there. There's a lot more I can say on all these issues, but I think your question in a time of Trump is the $64,000 question. And I think we have all the ingredients. We haven't put together the strategic formulation or the resources to bring us into the majority that we've already built.
Jim, I appreciate your response. I'm going to lay out a thought in several different areas, and then take any one of those that you wish to evolve your own insights on. I would say, let us wait to see what the evidence itself presents, because I also see how biased the media, both the alternative and mainstream media, has been. And as a journalist, I like to see what is the actual, what can we prove? And based upon what we can prove, that's the actions that we then take. And it'll come out soon enough, whether or not he did conspire, to what degree, with whom, or did not. And then we, the American people as a whole, can decide how we want to feel and what we want to do about that. Now, I want to go back for a moment, because one of the things I believe is happening is that the liberal community and the conservative community are considered the only ways of viewing the crisis in our lives. The trouble is they've been highly politicized. I would not be as forgiving of Obama as many people are, in that he got caught in the swamp. I believe he was an alligator dressed like a lamb. He gleefully entered the swamp. He did everything humanly possible that someone who's a part of the establishment, knowing the rewards, just like Clinton, the rewards are there.
Yeah, I agree.
And as a result, I don't believe that his integrity, intellect as a constitutional scholar were compromised. I believe he was compromised and then saw an opportunity. I believe a lot of politicians and celebrities and others do the same thing. I believe we have to take a big step back, a big step, because we're too close to the raw emotion. It's as if we keep touching that nerve, and the nerve then causes pain, either on one side or the other. First, let's look at what's happening to the world. I have interviewed at least 15 leading climatologists. Most are professors, and two are professor emeritus, who've published hundreds of papers. And they have said that we have only a maximum of 9 years as a planet without it going into feedback loops that will not be stoppable. 9 years. That is the most liberal They've also said as few as next year. If the Arctic goes completely ice-free this summer, which they believe it will in July or August, then in the spring, in many areas of the northern latitude, including in North Dakota and other places, you won't be able to grow grains easily. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to be grain-free. It means there are other states that can grow it, other countries that can grow it. But it begins the cycle of now you have to select. If you're wealthy enough, you don't care. You can always have food anywhere in the world brought to you or here in the United States, no matter what, you have to pay for it. But the world itself can no longer be the breadbasket. The breadbasket of the United States, the seven states that comprise that breadbasket, no longer will be able to do so because the soil will be too hot. You also have coming at us, they say, you'll start seeing the desertification of the Middle East. Now, when we're talking about the Middle East, we're also talking about Western Mediterranean. So we're talking about not just Mesopotamia. We're not just talking about Algeria and Egypt and Syria, and which was the breadbasket of the Middle East, Syria was, which is what caused its drought for 4 years, was the principal causation of the conflict that we see there now, or the opportunity for other foreign nations to use that to cause destabilization. But in any case, all that area of the world, including Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, are going to be desertified in very short order. They also say that when the Larsen Sea Shelf breaks, which is the largest iceberg in history ever recorded, the size of Delaware, and it should break any day now. Any day you're going to hear in the news that it broke. Now, that will not increase the water because it's already in the water. And it would be like ice in a glass melting. It doesn't raise the volume of the CO2 in the or the water in the glass, but it will open up to the largest free calving area in history, meaning the enormous slant, the high level of gravitational pull will calve massive amounts of ice into the Arctic or Antarctic, and could raise the feedback loop potential to where in 1 year you could have the raising of the water by 5 to 10 feet. You also have more forest fires. We had 12,000 unique weather events in the last 12 months. 12. We had 7 once in 500-year events in the United States in the last 12 months. 7 in 1 year. You're going to have Category 5 hurricanes hitting the United States, more of them than ever before. So when you look at the environment, when you look at the acidification of the ocean, the rising temperature, the death of sea coral, the death of fish and mammals that depend upon that, that doesn't even touch opening it up for drilling, the potential disaster for that. The clathrates coming up from the frozen soil at the bottom, which is now going to release megatons of methane. And then the whole Siberian tundra starts to thaw out, as it is now. And the whole of the boreal forest thaw out. And so what you're seeing is you're seeing a feedback loop that cannot be stopped. Nothing we're going to do is going to stop this. It's just that the very ultra-conservatives within the environmental movement have wanted to downplay this. Well, yeah, it's happening, but not that bad. Certainly not in your lifetime. And I'm saying, they're saying, oh, yeah, it's happening now. It's been happening. There were 123,000 extreme weather events in the last 12 months in the world. But if you're not in an extreme event, you don't appreciate it. If you're not in Louisiana about 5 months ago when it flooded, the worst flooding in the state's history, and in one county, 63,000 homes were damaged because they'd never been flooded. They didn't have flood insurance. If you don't have flood insurance and your home's destroyed and you can't get back in because of mold, you're not in the news. There's no agency helping you. You're on your own.
Exactly.
And so all these things happening on the environment. Then we take the five bubbles, the equity bubble on Wall Street. It should be about 8,000. It's at 20, going to 22,000. It's all a bubble. The credit card bubble at 1.1 trillion. The student bubble, 1.3 trillion. The car loan bubble, 1 trillion. Credit card bubbles, 7 trillion. Mortgage bubbles at 16 trillion. Corporate debt bubble, 25 trillion. Unfunded entitlements and underfunded entitlements, 77 trillion. State bubbles that they cannot possibly, and debt they cannot possibly ever pay for, 6 trillion. You're looking at gross domestic product of 18 trillion and debt of 170 trillion. We have the highest debt to income in the world. We are totally bankrupt. Yet no one is bringing any of this into the equation of why did we have this? What can we do to reverse it? What can we do? Forgive debt. Yes, we're not talking about it. Then you also have the environmental bubble, the environmental crisis, the economic crisis, and then you have the equity crisis. You have, right now in the United States, you have 10.2 millionaires, four people per family. You're dealing with 40 million millionaire or people who have access to millions. Hence, when you see people going to NYU at 70,000 or 72,000 a year plus room and board, which makes it about 100,000, who can afford that? And they don't have debt. Someone's paying for it. So those are the people who go out and they'll spend money on anything they want. And yeah, they're not going to go vegan. They don't care about saving the environment. They're highly educated. They tend to be the most educated because the emphasis on education and career. But they want to go down to Wall Street. They want to be a part of the big players. They want something more. So you have one group of people between the professional class of 16.8 million times their children. So what you're doing lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, architects, CPAs, business managers who are making between $100,000 to $400,000 a year. And their kids are now being treated as if they are the same parents of millionaires. So they're spending money they don't have. So they're the debt parents. They're always under stress. And their kids want to do everything else the rich kids do. So now you're dealing with about 40 million children in the United States between 0 and 18, or the millennials who are part of that. They don't care about the environment. They don't care about the body politics. They don't care about progressive, liberal, Democrat, independent. They don't care about the state of our economy. They don't care about the wars. They couldn't tell you where Iraq is. They couldn't tell you, over 5% couldn't tell you where the United States is. That's how functionally illiterate this so-called educated class is. So we cannot leave out of the equation looking at the state of our economy, the state of the environment, the state of our body politics, completely corrupt, and how many people are disconnected from this reality of correction. Your thoughts?
Well, I think everything you've said is correct. I think that everywhere one looks, particularly at how climate change is spinning out of control, one sees basically three things. One, an escalating crisis. Two, the unwillingness or inability of our governing elites to do anything about it. And number three, a largely apathetic, uninformed, consumerized public. And I would add another major component, Gary, to your list, which I think is very important for all of us to take in, and that is the complete loss of any kind of privacy. We're in a world right now where, in addition to the crises that are besetting us on all fronts, we're in a world where we're all now been reduced to commodities of information. And if you look at this whole domain of analytic marketing, they now, these marketing governments, it's what Trump did through Cambridge Analytics. If you know that whole story, I'm sure you do. They know about 4,000 to 5,000 bits of information now on every single one of us. And if you think of all your communications on Facebook or your email or your texts or your Snapchats or your WhatsApps, this and Instagram and so forth, those are all retrievable. And so we're in a world now where both the corporations and the governments and agencies of all sorts have access to almost unlimited data on every single human being in the world, mostly in the capitalized, industrialized parts of the world, obviously. And we're being sold and bartered as pieces of information and being consumed as people with a complete lack of privacy. And I would add that as a major other component happening simultaneously. So the question, particularly on climate change, becomes critical because you need an informed public and you need an active government. You know, no matter what you or I do about recycling or being vegans, it's not until the governments of the world step in and outlaw oil drilling, close down the coal plants, and begin massive reforestation, et cetera, would we even begin to be able to turn this thing around? So we're in one of these conundrums where, you know, Buckminster Fuller said, you know, don't even pay attention to the dying order. You just build the new order. That's true to a certain extent, but you can't take it the whole way. So in addition to the progressives organizing among themselves, they also have the additional challenge of organizing effectively at the macro political and I would say sociological level. So for example, in the last three presidential elections, climate change was never on the agenda. It wasn't part of the presidential debates. I think they, because of public pressure, there was one question asked between Hillary and Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on climate change, but they gave, you know, sophomoric answers. So you've got a problem in the world now that is so complex, you know, that we're in hyper complexity. We're no longer in complexity. Complexity was when you and I were kids in the 60s, 70s, where you had issues that were complex, but they could often be handled in isolation with one another. We're now in a world of what IBM and others calls hypercomplexity because all the boundaries between the crises are breaking down. And that means little events anywhere can ricochet through the global system and have major consequences everywhere, sometimes catastrophically and completely out of the blue. And I would say another point I would add to your list is just the phenomenon that of disruptive politics as we're seeing disruptive climate. I mean, we're seeing an increase in both the frequency and the severity of extreme weather events, as you state. But that's not just happening in the weather. That's happening in every quadrant. Donald Trump is an example of disruptive politics. The Brexit vote that took the UK out of the European Union is an example of disruptive politics. The refugees flowing dramatically by the millions into Europe is disruptive politics. You know, there's more water refugees in the world today than war refugees. There's more enforced migration now than any time in human history. We're in a situation. I was just in Asia, which is another indicator of the crisis that we're in. There was a report that was released by the ASEAN government. That's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, 10 nations, basically between India and China. And it was saying 1 million young people enter the job market every 30 days in Southeast Asia. And depending on the country, there's between 100 and maybe 150, 200,000 jobs for the million people coming in every 30 days. So on top of everything else, you've got overpopulation. So what the progressives do in the middle of this is not clear. And I think that's one of the reasons for our paralysis. And we're all torn by allegiances. For example, I'm the founder and and a prime mover of Ubiquity University. We're just moving out into the global market. I didn't expect Donald Trump to win. I'm a 10th generation American, and I'm watching this guy basically shred the constitutional system that my forefathers designed and brought into the world. And I was really torn. Do I stop and work full time on the impeachment of Donald Trump? Or do I surrender that and work full time on building Ubiquity, which is trying to bring into the global market a whole new way of learning so that we can change consciousness at a mass level in a short period of time and create progressives in the young people all over the world. That's my goal with Ubiquity University. I'd like in 10 years everybody in the system to be listening to PRN. So a lot of us are almost being rent asunder by the news every day because it's all critical and we're under-resourced and understaffed. We don't know quite what to do, so we just keep doing what we're doing in the hopes that somehow it's going to change. And when it changes, it seems to be getting worse, not better.
Let me share some additional thoughts on what you've just pointed out. Who goes to the demonstrations? Now, I've personally led over 180 demonstrations on at least 9 major issues. Back in the 60s and early 70s, it was DDT, so we could get it banned. That was all based upon the work of the outstanding and what I consider an American hero, Rachel Carson, and her work, Cynthia's work on Silent Spring. We then also have the marches against the war in Vietnam, against going to war in Iraq. But the ones that the average person does not engage in, outside of the big ones, like, you know, we don't want to go to war, is how many show up for the march against, let's say, Monsanto? Or how about the corruption at the CDC when it comes to all these mandatory vaccines? And you have a list of all the different agencies that are corrupt, but the trouble is the people tune out to most of them. So when you do have a demonstration, it's almost always something local, like when someone gets shot and there's a question, you know, did they do something that would warrant being shot? And why is it the police never do a talk down? Why is it all has to be a shoot to kill? Why not, if you're going to shoot someone and you have no other choice, why not shoot them in the leg, not the heart? And I just don't understand this. A lot of my friends are police, and my friends have never taken their two friends who were 25 years in the force, New York City Police Force, never took their gun out of their holster. They talk down every issue. So if they can do it, others can do it as well. But why don't we have those dialogues? So what we see is we see angry people in a local situation over what they perceive as an injustice, which very well may be an injustice. But we're not looking at the larger system that exists in, the militarization of the police, making petty non-crimes suddenly, you can go to jail for this. I watched a video, I posted it on my website, of a young person, a young woman, going across the street on Austin's campus. And there was a police officer there and went over, and the woman was jaywalking, right? There was no traffic. She's on a college campus. She walks across the street, right? She's tackled, roughed up, handcuffed, arrested, and charged. And, of course, they always charge you with resisting arrest. And here's the irony. A lot of people get charged with resisting arrest. Well, then what was the primary charge? Well, there was no charge. Well, how can you arrest someone if there wasn't a charge? And we had this lunacy in the media that, well, we don't want to explore that. Asset forfeiture. $4 billion last year was stolen from Americans by the police, and who committed no crime. These people were not given any summonses. They were not given tickets. They were not given. They just stole their money. In Oklahoma, and I'm so disturbed by Oklahoma, I won't even go there to lecture because of how corrupt the state is. It's already polluted itself to death. And just like Kansas having more earthquakes than any place else in America, Kansas and Oklahoma, and it's just a cesspool. But then the police there have this little machine that they take your credit card, put your credit cards in, put your debit cards in, and can withdraw all the money out of your bank accounts. You've committed no crime. They've just pulled you over, and then they say, we suspect that you may have gotten this money through drugs. What do you mean drugs? Well, you're on a highway, and on this highway, we have arrested people for doing drugs. This is the insanity of the police state, but no one's questioning the police state. If you're not going to question the police state, the evisceration of the Constitution, making the privatization of prisons, the exploitation of private prisoners for profit by major corporations, if you're not going to question the garment you're wearing and did it come from Bangladesh, where people make 14 cents an hour and are slave labor, if you're not going to question the sugar in a soft drink could contribute to diabetes in your kid, if you're not questioning the third part of deadly storm is people's health care. I mean, we only question who's covered by what program, but we never question why in the hell are we so diseased. We don't question the fact that the National Institute of Mental Health say we got 40 million Americans suffering from mental illness. And then the next part of that is they should be diagnosed and they should be treated with psychoactive drugs. And we don't question, is that science or is that pathologizing life to make a profit? We don't question the fact that our legislators almost uniformly vote in allegiance with the vested lobbyists and the people that paid the money. We don't question how bad science has become, how proprietary it's become, where you can't trust a lot of peer-reviewed journals because there's so much corruption in science. We don't question the inefficiency and the deadliness of medicine. The number one cause of death every single year for the last 20 years, the number one cause is not cancer, not strokes, not heart attacks, not diabetes. It is your physician. Doctors each year engage people and only in institutions. They're not even counting the figures, Jim, if you got treated in a hospital and went home and died at home. Only in an institution, it's anywhere from 500,000, 600,000 to a million. Now, over the last 20 years, that's 10 million Americans died. I call it medical genocide. Are there meetings, discussions? Is there a panel? Nothing. Is there any effort to reform it, to change it, to improve it, to make it safer? Nothing. Is it there just to exploit $3.5 trillion out of the American economy for themselves? Yes. So here we have a society that's run amok. It is run amok economically, educationally. We're graduating functional illiterates. Now, you're a professor. I'm a professor. I've been in education for 35 years at Fairleigh Dickinson and Sydney, all these other places I've taught. And there was a time when students came into a class, you had their undivided attention most of the time, and they really were curious. They wanted to know, how can I become a more critical thinker? How can I use what I can learn in this class to better prepare me for the world outside? Today, almost it's rare for that to happen. We don't question the curriculum. We don't question how it's taught. We don't question the floating standards where you take an A and you take an F and you float it as a C for those that would otherwise get an F. We don't question anything anymore because it will become, by someone's notion, politically unacceptable. So what do you do then when you pull back far enough to see how broken all of our systems are to make a change and not have people run into that buzzsaw of frustration and realize, well, I tried this and it didn't work, and I couldn't get anyone to do that and it didn't work, and nobody wanted to change their diet, and nobody wanted to, you know, to get money out of politics, and nobody wanted to go into careers that actually helped the environment and people. Yeah, there are people making changes, but they're not the ruling dominant. And my final thought for your final answer on this is this. My audience knows that for 33 years, I was a research fellow in anti-aging medicine at the Institute of Applied Biology. But there was another thing I did there that didn't get any publicity because the director says, no one's going to understand this, Gary, on our board. And the 16 different departments would ask you to leave if they knew. I did what was called psi research. And I just wanted to see what we can understand about things that are beyond the boundaries of orthodoxy.
Yep.
Cause and effect, Newtonian reduction. And I did the first study that it was ever published in the Journal of Psychotronic Research that showed that human beings could transfer their energy into rats and cure the rats 6 out of 6 times over a 2-year period, including Dr. Dolores Krieger, who founded Therapeutic Touch based upon that. And I then reason the universe will never give us a half of a truth. It gives us a full truth. But we're not always ready for that full truth. And here's what I came up with. I'm not going to go into the full explanation. It would be too long for this audience, and it may seem a little existential. But here's how I see a lot of our problems being solved and why a lot of them are not. I believe that well-intentioned people, people who want to be healthy, people who want to be happy, people who want to have a healthier world, people want to respect the environment, people don't want to see drilling, don't want to see corrupt politics, want to drain the swamp, want to get ethical people in charge, want to live by a higher moral perspective than just religious dogma and ritual, that these people may not be actualizing this even though they're conscious and aware of it because of the epigenetic underlying conditioned negative responses that they were imbued with early in life that now becomes the dominant energy. And much of that is based upon insecurity. Insecurity can lead you to become angry, rageful, jealous, envious, greedy, needy, manipulative, lying, conniving. If that's the dominant energy, you have to hide it. You have to make it seem as if there's a sweet peach underneath, you know, and here it is when it's really a bitter lemon. So you don't know until you get to someone and see what they actually do. Yeah. We listen to what they say, and everybody knows how to give a good talk. But do they walk it? And so when the society is imbued with this epigenetic conditioning, almost always there will be one dominant energy. Because as you know, you can't have two competing energies sharing the same space at equal intensity at the same time. So for every dominant energy, fear, anger, depression, greed, insecurity, uncertainty, that dominates, and everything else that is wholesome, spiritual, is submissive to it. And as a result, it confuses us. Why do good people do bad things? Smart people do stupid things. Why can't we just do what is right, which is easy and self-evident? And I believe it's because we haven't understood how to understand what energy we're actually living through, even if it's not discussed or shown, and how to reverse that so you put your spiritual energy on top. Your final thoughts? We have 2 minutes.
One of the things that we're prioritizing in the research department at Ubiquity is the psi research. And I believe that the exploration of the paraphenomenal and the unexplainable by the current scientific paradigm is a crucial aspect of the kind of leadership that we need in the progressive community. I would also say, Gary, as the hour draws to a close, I come down to one point. And that is, I think the time has come for each and every one of us, in the light of all the things that we've laid out in the last hour, to make a deepened commitment to walk their talk and to be more authentic human beings as a result of what they now know to be true. I believe that Margaret Mead was right when she said it's a small group of people with a common commitment that end up changing the world, and that, in fact, she said, it's the only way that the world has ever really been changed, when a small group of people come together. And I've always respected and appreciated you, because I feel every time we interact, I'm feeling a man who has burned to the center of his soul and knows who he is and is who he is in every dimension of his being. And I aspire to do that as well. And I'm finding that as I deepen my awareness of the crisis that we're in, I'm feeling a deepened sense of moral imperative to me to be more fully human as an individual. And I'll give you just one closing example. I was in Nepal last year, and the level of poverty and the systematic impoverishment of Nepal by the major corporate governmental interests is awful. And by the end of it, it happened on the last day, I met a beggar, young woman begging, child on her hip, and another one came in, and they said, we don't want any money. We just want you to buy us some milk and some rice. And I did that. And to make a long story very short, I decided there and then I was going to support these two little women. Does it solve the problem of poverty in Nepal? Doesn't even begin to. It's not even a drop in the bucket. But am I making a difference in a couple of women and a handful of children's lives week by week and month by month? Yes, absolutely. So in the face of all that we know to be true, we have ourselves and what we do with our time. And so I appreciate the integrity of this conversation, and it's deepened my resolve to be more fully human by becoming more fully authentic. So thank you.
Jim, thank you very much. And Jim Garrison's websites are wisdomuniversity.org and ubiquityuniversity.org. I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying.